You are now listening to the EU Startups Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the EU Startups Podcast. As always, I'm your host, David Sendon-Garcia, the news editor here at EU Startups. Today, I chatted with Dr. Patrick Andre. He's the co-founder of the vacation rental platform Home2Go. It was founded in Germany in 2014, and in 2021, it went IPO. So he brings that specific background as a beginning startup all the way from pre-seed to an IPO, where he sees the company moving forward post the IPO, and even the effects that COVID had on the travel industry, which surprising had a positive effect, especially when it comes to vacation rentals. We also chat about, well, the impact that vacation rental platforms like Home2Go, whether it's Airbnb or whatever, have on large cities like the ones where we're now based in Barcelona, that have that tension between vacation rental homes and tourist populations and the effect it has on the local population. We were also able to chat about where he sees the European innovation ecosystem moving forward. He himself is an angel investor. So it was interesting to chat with him about that. And afterwards, we actually had to start another recording because we realized we were chatting about something that was actually quite interesting. It should be on the record. And that's the impact that companies like Lovable have had on AI automation when it comes to building websites, when it comes to starting a company, and his thoughts on it because he initially was a programmer. So I hope you're looking forward to that. But before, a quick message from our sponsor, Vanta.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority, but to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vanta comes in. Vanta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vanta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VCSOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vanta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstars startups, who trust Vanta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vanta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
Thank you, Patrick, for coming on to the EU Startups Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me. Very nice to be here. Yeah.
Great. I'm excited to have this chat with you today. There is an element that I think you bring that is kind of special to, with a lot of the founders that we speak to, is that you bring this extra knowledge of taking a startup all the way post IPO, you know, and that's something that is very special and that I think brings a lot of value to this conversation today. So I want to thank you for coming on, and I want to give you the chance to begin with to present yourself, your company, and what you do.
Yes. So thank you very much again for having me. So I'm Patrick. I'm one of the founders and CEO of Home2Go. I'm CEO since the beginning. My personal number is really 001. Yeah. Today we are around 1,500 people. And we started the company in 2014. Prior, I was originally studied law and business, have a PhD in law.
Doctor. I can see that. Dr. Yeah. Patrick. Yes.
But I started like working with computers when I was 12, 13, and building small things. And then suddenly HTML and so on, the internet came around. And I basically started them programming websites, building them, designing them, worked for a local ISP already internet service provider with 16 as web designer, how it was called back then. And when I was finished with my studies and still was doing that on the side, actually like bringing this all together at Rocket Internet, where I worked prior founding Home2Go, latest stage was there at Home24 furniture store for Europe. And then in 2014, we started then Home2Go. So I have two co-founders and I started with them. And since then, we do this. Yeah. And basically since 2021, you just said it, we are also on the German Stock Exchange and still rolling. Yeah.
Great. Well, I always find that the best place to begin these conversations really is to hear a bit more about at what moment you saw that there was a gap, you know, in the market. At what point did you think, okay, there's something here that needs to be filled and I can fill it?
Yeah. I think like usually, you know, like a lot of these problems that you might see in the market stem from personal, like, kind of frustration, you can say, right? Like, and I'd say, like, finding a vacation rental was something that was cumbersome, yeah? So what Home2Go does, so we are today Europe's leading vacation rental group, and I come to that in a second, what that means. But when we started Home2Go, we started Home2Go as a meta search engine for vacation rentals. Yeah, because we had two beliefs, actually, you can say. Yeah. So one was that vacation rentals becoming more mainstream. Yeah. And also started with a classical, we believed in the classical vacation rental, really for the vacation. So rural area, going to the Baltic Sea or to the seaside at all, Baltic Sea in Germany, a lot of things, but like mountains, like really what you use for vacation. And the big problem was there wasn't anyone that really was bringing that all together, the inventory that existed in the market on one platform. So highly fragmented, also very unprofessional market and to a certain extent. And so we thought, okay, why is there actually no meta search for vacation rentals if there's one for flights or a lot of companies for flights and the same for hotels? In a market that is even more fragmented and more complicated to get an overview on. And so that's how we started in the beginning, Home2Go as a meta search engine, and then took an evolution over a marketplace to today being a B2B focused business. But we probably speak a little bit more about that in a second. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And that kind of makes me wonder, was there any worry from your end in the beginning that you were entering the travel tech sector, which obviously you have a background in site development, you know, programming, but was there any fear on your end of entering a sector that you didn't have any professional experience in?
I would say so if I would have done it my own, probably, yeah, or just alone. But that's why you try to obviously have like a combination of co-founders that bring maybe sure. different topics together. And in our specific case, it was like my co-founder Niels, he had a vacation rental website, an OTA for vacation rentals before that was called Casamundo that he sold to a Dutch company that then later belonged to Axel Springer. And we bought the brand or the company back later then. And my other co-founder Wolfgang, he had a website called Swoodoo, which back then was the leading meta search for flights in German-speaking markets. He sold it to Kayak, that probably everyone knows, and was then MD for Europe in Kayak. Every German, my age group, by the way, knows Wolfgang's company, Swoodoo. So, like, nonetheless, so to your question, and I learned execution and some other things at Rocket. So in the end, sure. we had a vacation rental guy, a meta search guy, and the execution guy, and it was a good like kind of combination, I would say. Yeah, so like I needed to rely on my two co-founders in the beginning to being like in the travel industry. But the good thing about the travel industry, also with anyway getting talent on board, is always that you have something that people can rely to. Yeah, because everyone travels usually, yeah. so people can relate to this kind of thing. And obviously, now after 12 years, if I want it or not, I'm got to a certain extent an expert in travel, but especially in vacation rentals. Yeah. So yeah.
Hmm. Well, and it seemed to work out, obviously. I can see the t-shirt there behind you with the Home2Go logo. So clearly there's been influence from the company. And as we mentioned in the beginning, this eventually leads to an IPO in 2021. So I'm curious, and this might be a huge and too broad of a question, but I'll ask you to maybe try to figure a way of answering it. But I want to hear about the evolution of yourself as a founder from the very beginning of a startup, when you have the idea, you find some co-founders, you're slowly trying to get funding, and all the way to the end of post an IPO. What did you kind of see as major changes in the way you approach being a founder?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question, because the problem with doing that assessment is not that I didn't change. I hope I changed a lot, because otherwise I wouldn't have learned anything. Yeah, the thing is more like that. As you are looking in the mirror, and you might not see like every day how you get older, and then you maybe look at the picture from 10 years ago and say, "Oh, I changed." Yeah, mm-hmm. It is not like that. Founding the company, and then you put yourself next to how it is today, or how it was prior to the IPO or after the IPO. But I honestly believe, that there are a lot of things that changed in how this journey as a founder went, and also hopefully how I did an evolution over the time, right? Like, so simply because of experience, and experience is nothing else than biological A/B testing or machine learning, however you want to call it. Yeah, and so obviously, like, there is the thing that when we started Home2Go, when we wanted to create a new company, so one of my topics about creating a company was, on one hand, I wanted to try it. I did it prior in smaller, like, kind of things next to my studies and other things, but I never did it like at that scale. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had also like a lot of ideas and things that I wanted to do better than we maybe did them at Rocket Internet, which for some things were easy, because everyone knows it's not the place. It was not the place for big cultural, like, kind of things. It was simply like the place where you worked a lot, but you learned a lot, and you got like a lot of responsibility early and a lot of money to do things. So it was a fast-paced learning environment, but also one that is not necessarily sustainable if you want to do it over 10 years or something like this.
Sure.
And I got a lot of, I took a lot of things out of that environment that I wanted to do differently, or maybe same. And there were also like a lot of things that I thought maybe a little bit arrogant when I was going out there, that they were easily to be done better, which I realized then over time, it might not be that easy if you not have your own like view from your own part of a business, but if you are sitting on top of a business and have a lot of more topics to take care of, right? Like, and potential problems, opportunities, and things that arise all the time, where like, simply like the angle of the viewpoint might change, unfortunately, things that you thought earlier would be much easier. Mm. But for me, like, this whole travel, like, from founding the company, like, as I said, like, personal number 01 to now roughly 1,500, is something that that has changed nonetheless things how I do. We went through a lot of things also, like, full circle, where I might have thought like we would try this, and then come back to how we started with doing it, because mm-hmm. that's also how evolution works in the end. Yeah, you try things out. If they work, you keep them. If they don't work, you maybe like put them back. It's like with product. Yeah, I also see that for organizational and cultural exploration, that no one knows exactly what is the best. And even if something works for one company, you can get like some kind of ideas from it. But if it works for your company, different business, different cultural aspects, different people. So you always have to see what works and adapt. And so, but have an open mindset to try things out and pull them into like your organization, so that the organization grows, but also yourself, right? Like, I'm a big fan. I wouldn't say necessarily, and I heard that recently, and I like it because I'm not necessarily a big fan of advice. Yeah. And I heard that recently in another podcast where someone said he doesn't want to have advice. He wants he more looks into relevant experience. And I really like that because that's actually probably what I was looking for. But I haven't said it that clearly prior. Yeah? because it's easy to have advice. Yeah, but if you really have been there, like as a founder or as someone in a similar position, it touches simply more topics, and therefore it's usually the better advice if someone that really was living through that same situation, so has relevant experience, gives it to you on average, right? Like I don't want to rule that fully out, that there isn't good advice from people who might not have done it, but like in general, I think that's a very good way to look at these things.
Well, and I also imagine that a particular challenge must have been during COVID, and we're talking about, you know, how you progressed and you're hoping you changed and that you evolved as a founder. I imagine a particular specific challenge must have been directing a travel tech company through a period where nobody was traveling. And so we're talking IPO in 2021, the COVID pandemic started, 2020? If I remember, so you it must have been a little bit of a gamble, right? To kind of go straight into the pandemic to an IPO. And I want to hear a little bit about how kind of Home2Go addressed that moment of uncertainty that the entire travel sector was experiencing.
Yeah, I think like I can still remember that because usually we did fundraising in the beginning of the year. Yeah, because vacation rentals is a market that travel is generally very seasonal, but especially vacation rentals even more. So a lot of people book in the first quarter. And so usually we did there our fundraising because like even if you explain to investors that your business is seasonal, they might get confused if the month is less than the month before and so on. And January is always the best month. So we did there. We had a great start actually in 2020. and then...
it was a good year before all of that. Yeah.
Sorry?
It was a good year before all of that happened.
Yeah. And we actually had also a good run in the fundraising like kind of thing. And then I can still recall when we were in London and we're joking, maybe it's the last time we are here for a long time and we were there for fundraising, and it was. nonetheless, me and my co-founders, we saw when China wasn't getting it under control, we started already earlier to look into contingency plans because we didn't want to be caught guard off, especially as we were just about to fundraise. And so we were prepared when it then came to all the closings and these types of things. And so, it like every travel company, we are suddenly faced with, you're growing and suddenly you're minus 90%, right? Like year over year, almost zero. Yeah. And in April, we always thought that vacation rentals is the last that get hit and the first to recover because from the simply like if you have this pandemic, right? So generally, vacation rentals are known for being in any type of critical situation. Yeah, may it be like financial crisis, may it be other crises. They are rather like stable and sometimes even profit from crisis. Why is that? Because it's usually the much cheaper thing and it's a very domestic thing. Yeah, so if people are afraid, they stay home. Yeah, because they don't want to go too far away. They also might want to save money. And per person, you can go there by car. You can pack it with your children. You can go to the supermarket. You can cater yourself. So it's not only the stay that is cheaper, but especially also like as you have all the appliances, you can then cook because it's like a home.
Yeah, right. So for local So for kind of close by vacation rentals, that's what you mean.
So for, not only close by, but generally, right? Like so people tend in vacation rentals is simply like a travel form where a lot of people go domestic. Yeah, probably because they go closer with a car. Yeah, when we see that in our data, it usually you have people that go domestic, but even more interesting is actually roughly 1,000 kilometers around your hometown, because it's a one-day drive. Yeah, so people, for instance, in the north of Germany, they more go also to the Scandinavian countries, whereas if you're living in Munich or in Bavaria, right, like in one day, you not only can go to Italy, but you can also go to Croatia, which is maybe a little bit of a headache if you come from Hamburg or something like this. Yeah, and so what I'm trying to say is, like, we knew that this is the general environment, and then in a pandemic where you needed to distance from each other, vacation rentals had a natural advantage over hotels, yeah, because you could stay with your family. Yeah, and so one investor back then, he told me an interesting thing that still sticks with me, because he said, because everyone has had their own like kind of risk assessment towards like the pandemic. He said, I don't really care about the pandemic that much, but I don't want to go out of the hotel room and put on my mask and put on the gloves to do something. In a vacation rental, I can't forget about this, because it's just like at home, right? Like I'm at that vacation rental, and I don't have to think about if I leave that I have to put on a mask because I'm outside. Yeah, so and so that's why we thought, okay, vacation rentals will be likely the last to be hit and the first to recover, because theoretically, which wasn't the case then that much, also like authorities should like give access to them first, because they are the least option to get infectious with other people. Nonetheless, so minus 90% April. In May already, we were at only at minus 25% year over year, because to the end of May in Germany, which is our biggest market, the authorities opened up again that you can travel from, I can't recall, it was end of May or beginning of June or something. And so like people started booking already like crazy. Yeah. And then in June and so on, I could have sold like my inventory 3-4 times with barely marketing. Yeah. So like in June, we were versus 2019, we were growing more than 100% or around 100%. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's what people usually don't see, right? Like they still in 24, even maybe in 25, but more in 24, 23, people were asking, oh, are you back to pre-COVID levels? And I said, I was never in the end below, actually, really, because if you look at our numbers, we were roughly at the same level in 2020, in the end, full year blended, what we were in 2019, obviously with super high amplitude, right? Like, because going down, going up, then to the winter came the next wave, right? Like everything was closed again. And so this was like basically the thing that was happening there. Nonetheless, during the time when it hit and we were in fundraising, so we didn't have endless money, right? Like, because usually you don't fundraise if you still have 3 years of a runway. That was probably one of the most shocking moments, like within the company, because suddenly you saw, okay, maybe it can go all away even without you being like the reason for it, because you made a wrong decision. It's just like taken out of your hands. Yeah. The good thing was that also with our current investors, we could agree back then that this wasn't our fault. So we bridged that kind of financing, got a good financing around that because luckily, obviously, like when then the market was going up again and proving our theory, it was also easier to go then further. And to your question about, or an implicit question about IPO, why do IPO in that time? The thing was that many people forget that Airbnb went public in 2020 in the autumn, which is very interesting, because everyone was telling me like, why are they going in the midst of the pandemic why they are going public. And I said, if their numbers look roughly like ours from the summer, so basically no marketing spend, yeah, and a lot of people just buying the stuff, yeah,
yeah.
It might be a good chance actually for them to go to the market, right? Like, and this like kind of narrative, it's the brand. It's, we don't need paid marketing and so on, was also great. I would say accelerator for them going to the market. And after Airbnb went to the market, people were coming after us. Hey, do you want to go to the market? So there was something that played into that direction. And so, like, we simply saw the opportunity back then that it was also the best opportunity for us to get additional money into the company faster and then utilize it further, what we did it now throughout the years, right? Like, because Home2Go last year, with the last acquisition, we call it pro forma numbers and so on, blah, blah, blah. We did roughly 400 million or 394 million in revenues as a combined group with 42 million in adjusted EBITDA, which is compared to when we went to the stock market where we weren't profitable, where we said we will get profitable within until 23, which we did. And now we add on top and have more than four times the revenues, yeah. Is I think like showing that we did the right thing on the operational side. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it's so surprising to me because I definitely asked you that question expecting to hear some kind of sad story about the challenges of COVID and the pandemic, but it does seem like very much it was a positive moment for all of you in terms that it boosted kind of engagement in a lot of ways with the platform. And you've mentioned Airbnb. I think that's a good opportunity to kind of move into a separate part of this conversation, which I think is an important one. And I think anybody who's tuning in to a podcast about a rental platform is bound to be curious about. And I, as long as I'm sure everybody would like to hear your thoughts on it. And it's the idea of that these kind of rental, vacation rental platforms, I mean, they've opened up access to many places, right? And we talk about going on nature's spree and all this, but also into cities, right? Into big touristy cities. Now, that kind of brings up a debate between housing pressures and tourism and that balance. And I kind of want to hear where Home2Go kind of lands on that conversation and also where you think platforms such as Home2Go, whether it's Airbnb or whoever, should be kind of looking towards.
Yeah, I think generally, so we talked a little bit how we started the company, right? Like, so our focus was really when we started the company, and today still is, this classical vacation rental that you use especially for your big summer holidays, right? Like, yes. Maybe on the seaside, maybe in the mountains, maybe in Tuscany, wherever, right? Like islands, Mediterranean Sea, Mallorca, and so this typical summer vacation spot. And that's usually something that's not in the city, yeah? So because like the big vacation people usually don't do in the city. And the second thing that we focused on was professionally managed inventory. Yeah, so that's how we started. So the functionality to add your own rental to Home2Go as a listing, we basically built in end of 2023 because people were asking for it. But the vast majority of our inventory still is like coming from property managers, professional property managers, and these types of things. So it's a different type, in general, or on average, a different type of inventory that has been a vacation rental for a long time. And it's not like this, oh, people going in a city and throwing out the tenant and then renting it out to tourists to come to the city. So it's a little bit different structure. Still, through our partners, yeah, we have also inventory in cities on Home2Go, yeah, though we make only a fraction of our revenues from that, or not a fraction, but a very small part, yeah. Mm-hmm. And So because our clear focus is this rural classical vacation rental topic. Yeah. So that's the first thing, right? Like looking at in the cities, I can totally understand living in Berlin, right? Like that this is not good. Yeah. If people that want to live in the city then suddenly get out or need to leave apartments that are then just for tourists, right? Like so it's totally good that there people are looking into how can that be well regulated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, if you look in the rural area, you have also some regulations, but the motivation usually also especially from touristic regions, because they live often from tourists, right, is a different view. Yeah. So because for them, it's very interesting. There's a good example, for instance, in Austria, when they put out new land to be developed, yeah, for building housing, they usually have like a three-tier approach. Yeah. So like one is for local residents. Yeah. Second is actually for people for properties that have a license to be rented out. Yeah. So, and the third is for second homes. So where people that are not living there buy it and only they live there. Why is that? Because the last category, and that's the smallest usually, is the one they want the least, because that might be people that go there 1 week or 2 weeks in a year for hiking or skiing, and then the rest of the time the building is empty. Yeah. So obviously the thing that they want most is people living there, but then the second most wanted thing is people, or like someone buying it that maybe goes themselves there, but the vast majority also rents it out so that the property is not like empty all the time, because if it's empty, there's no one that is helping the local businesses, yeah, like buying food or whatever, right? Like that tourists obviously do. And I think that's a little bit the thing that needs to be differentiated in a city where most of the people want to live because they work there or do other things. It's a little bit different than in a touristic region. And that's also why it's not like this one topic. We divided by city and rural, but in the end, it's also about like this topic about professional people doing it and people just trying to rent out something that wasn't maybe like rented out before. And it's good that in the end the EU also puts like general regulations, so not that every. Because that's how it then started. Every city, every village maybe puts out something, right? And you want, obviously, as for all of the businesses that operate in that area, you want more clarity, yeah? And best is one set of rules that is everywhere applicable, yeah?
Sure. I could keep picking your brain on this, because especially, you know, we're based in Barcelona and this is a big topic here, obviously. And there's been a lot of news around the subject, even, you know, to the point where people are spraying water on tourists just for, you know, just for looking like they're tourists or eating at a restaurant that's very touristy. So it's something that's very present for us here, but I am aware of the time and I did promise your comms person 30 minutes. So I'm gonna leave you with one last question here. I'm gonna leave you with one last question and then I'll let you go. And it's a shame. I do want to recommend people look at your newsletter, because I don't think Fortune we're gonna be able to touch on some of the topics you talk in there, but I found them very interesting. Things like main character energy, soul vacation. You know, there's all these kind of modern cultural trends, and I didn't even think that would be kind of influencing travel, but they are. You know, you mentioned things like Wuthering Heights has come out, and that's increased people's interest in Yorkshire, wherever it is that the movie's based. So all that stuff's fascinating, and I definitely recommend people to subscribe to newsletter, at least read it like I did. But the question I want to go with isn't that. The final part that I want to touch on is you're experiencing in investing, because I know you've also been active as an angel investor. I, I saw somebody somewhere, 50 plus startups. I don't know if that number is still accurate, but to give the audience an idea, somewhere around there. So I kind of want to touch that experience also, because you mentioned Rocket Internet and the work you did there as kind of also looking at what U.S. business models worked and how to kind of make them work within Europe. So with your background on that, and then your current active as an angel investor, your experience as a founder, putting all that together, I just kind of want to hear about where you see Europe kind of going right now in terms of the innovation that we're seeing here, the kind of tension between staying in Europe, going to the US, that kind of thing. You know, it's a small question, I know. So just if I could hear a little bit on where you see the current ecosystem.
Yeah, I think like the thing, and it's basically to a certain extent connected to the question before, right? Like, so I think like Europe, so I'm proud to be European. I would like to say this maybe first. Yeah, and I'm not a believer in just like going somewhere where the grass is greener. And obviously, but that's my personal take on it, right? Like I got education in Europe. I'm very happy to for free education most of the time, right? Like in Germany, and I also want to give something back, right? Like, so I don't see myself running somewhere for cheaper taxes or what a lot of people have special motivations. I love to be a European, yeah, and I love like the cultural background of the European continent. And anyway, as a travel company, Europe is still like, and maybe not only still, but rightly so, like the most visited like kind of a travel destination in the world, because of the cultural heritage and all these things, yeah, like a beautiful city like Barcelona, yeah, for instance. And sure. I think that is something that Europe is definitely a great like continent. Though, yeah, and I think that's that's the thing, and that's a bit the segue to the other topic, and not a surprise, I assume. We have to be very, very careful about all the regulatory things that we put into place or already put into place, and luckily are now like partially trying to pull back because people start understanding that we might have overdone it. Because usually like regulation, so no one is coming there, right? Like, and says, oh, I want to be mean and want to strangle these companies, because usually there's a good reason for doing regulation, because otherwise you wouldn't do it. But then on one hand, it might be people that not have relevant experience. Yeah, we talked about that as well, that are doing the legislation because they might not have worked, and how should they do, yeah, in the respective areas. And secondly, it's the amount of different areas that suddenly come on you, right? So with all good intentions usually, right? But if it's too many, at some point, you simply like start like getting your businesses, being held back, yeah. And the GDPR is a good idea, right? Like from where it comes from, CSRD is a good idea where it comes from, but like that everyone in the world is adopting to our high standards. And by the way, sometimes you also it's overregulated that some smaller companies or even individuals have to adhere to topics that they might not be capable to do. Yeah,
sure.
Is something that that is simply a competitive disadvantage. Yeah, and on top comes the fact that often then regulatory topics, or generally because we have 27 member states. Yeah, it's not like as easy as in the US where you have one market and obviously you have also states, but it's not that different how it is in Europe sometimes. And that's why, for instance, something like the EU Inc., yeah, which we and I also personally support, is a very, very good idea, because we have to move into that direction. And it's great to see that it got adopted, But we now have to see if it really is like doing what it was supposed to do. Nonetheless, it's the right step, right? Like, it's better to have something that goes into the right direction than say, complain that it's not fulfilling everything, yeah? So we just have to work on that it does more. So don't get that wrong, right? Like, because I'm also not someone that wants to stay and just like wants to see the negative, because it's actually a positive sign that we go into that direction. Nonetheless, we should try to pull it through and get also like the next steps done, yeah? This is the same also like if, for other regulation, right? Where you might have regulation on a EU level, but then for the operational cumbersome things like reporting or something like this, it's then still every member state can decide how they do it, yeah? So at least you know the legal framework then, but you still have to build like 27 in the worst case, like different types of reporting infrastructure, yeah?
Yeah.
And what I actually believe we need in the EU is also a better like kind of access to capital. Yeah, and I'm not talking about, oh, we need to have like state funds that fund companies, because in the end, you know, like you still find money globally where people come to you and basically give you money, or US VCs invest into Europe and so on and so on. It's a bit unfortunate, maybe the money doesn't stay in that kind of circle then. But in the end, you know, like you find that, and it's not necessarily needed that you need like state investments. But what we should have is, on one hand, a framework where also like in the US or in other jurisdictions, also in Canada and so on, where, for instance, pension funds and these are allowed to invest like a certain amount of their, or insurances, right, a certain amount of their wealth or their earnings into these categories. And secondly, this is the most important thing for me, we need to have a good combined capital market. Yeah, and I'm not that naive that I believe we will have one stock exchange. And maybe it's also not good for competition reasons, but at least you need this interoperability. What do I mean with that? So if you today want to buy Home2Go stock, for instance, yeah, which is on the German stock exchange, HTG is like the abbreviation, you wouldn't be able probably to do it with your Spanish like kind of stock market account. Whereas you can buy US stocks, usually through an ADR, so like this special listing, because companies are big enough, and so there's an incentive, but there might be not an incentive to have Home2Go there. But it would be much better if we have like some kind of a tech index for Europe, and then in any like stock exchange you are, you can like simply trade also via a tunnel, or however you solve it, you can do it without needing to have access exactly to this like kind of specific local domestic stock exchange. Because if you look at it, it's still very national. So most of the people that trade stocks on a certain stock exchange are the ones that that are actually living in that country. Yeah, and so, except for institutional investors and others. But like, so I think like there is this opportunity, and that would be a great, really like something where it would be great that the EU does something on their level and says simply like, okay, there's regulation that stock exchange need to by 28 make sure that you can trade these other things. Yeah, and it will work, because usually it's not magic to get these things done. Yeah, and so this is for me like one of the things that I really see, because in general Europe has really great talent. Yeah, we have a great like kind of educational system here, much broader than maybe in the US, but also sometimes in the UK, where you also like have more like these super universities or elite university kind of things. And so we have really like a broad like kind of talent pool, but currently too much of the talent pool actually goes to the US or gets absorbed by old companies, right? Because and one reason is that there's not such an easy way for access to money, especially also after you went public, because you simply see still like your nationwide like companies and not like this European company. Yeah?
Sure.
And so I think this is really something that we need to be aware of, because there are primary effects from, but a lot of secondary and maybe even third order effects that you see coming out of that.
This is why I think you specifically are such an interesting guest, because you kind of you're at the bleeding edge there of seeing what could be best for a startup that's even beginning at the very, you know, at just looking for a pre-seed funding, because you have an outlook of the entire process from the very all the way to, you know, where do you even go post IPO, you know, who knows? So all these things that you're talking about, really from a perspective of somebody who's just right there, right on the edge. As Patrick, as you've mentioned, you have this background in building websites, in a programmer. And just that background made me curious about how you look at today's automated tools. You know, Lovable has had great success. It's everywhere. We're constantly quoting them. We're constantly getting information from them because they're kind of a staple in European innovation right now. So I kind of want to hear, and I already did, but let's hear it on the record as to how you feel about these automated website building tools.
Yeah, it's actually funny, right? Like, because to a certain extent, it feels for me like coming full circle. Yeah. And if I speak to other people who maybe even engineers or so, they also feel like this, right? Like, so because when I started programming, engineering, yeah, so building websites, designing websites, and then building them mostly back then with HTML and JavaScript, right? Like, mm-hmm. which probably front-end engineers would laugh today a little bit about, but like back then it was the case how you did it, right? Like, so I was basically the product manager, the designer, and the front-end engineer, yeah? Mm-hmm. So like with all these new tools and the fast advancements in AI, you can actually see that these like kind of roles seem to merge again into, back then it was web designer, today you would probably call it builder, yeah, someone mm-hmm. who builds something. So it's very interesting. And the same is to a certain extent happening on the pure engineering side, if it's, I wouldn't say that it exists anymore, but like even there, right, like where you had like front engineers, back end engineers, in the past you had full stack engineers. And now with all the tools, also the full stack engineer or like the engineer can also do design parts, can do like product management mm-hmm. parts. So in the end also gets a builder. So it all gets even more merged together, because there are so many people that are getting enabled by these tools, right? And so I think that's really super cool to be in that time, right? Like what a fascinating timeline. So because when I grew up, the personal computer was rather new, right? Like when I had my first computer in the beginning of the 90s, yeah, then the internet came, yeah, as a big super cycle. Took us like 20 years until like the next thing, like really what was all imagined after the dot-com bubble bursted, like became true. In between, a little bit mobile, yeah, and now we have this next super cycle, which probably is will be much more accelerated, because on one hand people have the experience from the internet super cycle, so they want to bring things quicker back, and secondly it's also accelerating basically every day what AI and the LLMs can do. And so it's super fascinating to see and to look at all these like kind of products that get created, but also enable people to create for them. So I'm actually super excited for the possibilities that come out of that, and see what you can suddenly do again. Even I, yeah, where people might have said otherwise, oh, why are you are looking into these things? Because now it's easier and you don't have to spend weeks on it, right? Like, and so
sure.
I'm honestly, like even, yeah, some designing stuff, right? Like, because I was never like the person that said, oh, it's a craft to push a pixel somewhere, right? I was more thinking around like, okay, the actual craft is finding or selecting the right version, but now you can shortcut a lot of things and be faster. in creating things, which allows you to then like move faster from the beginning. And I think that's really, really cool to see.
Well, it is interesting because, as you say, there you could have it would have been as valid for you to take the other opinion of saying, you know, this is cheapening my craft, and it kind of makes it so that there's no more value in the hard work of a website programmer or builder. And it kind of I draw a line of similarity with journalism, because the journalism is also very divided right now on the same topic of automated tools. You know, where there are some very established journalists who say, "Don't you dare touch ChatGPT, you know, if I see you using that, you're not really a journalist and you're not really doing the work of a journalist." And yet there are easily as known figures who take the opposite edge and say, this is a tool like any other. And it's an advancement of the profession. And the same way it's like asking an NASA scientist to now use a calculator, you know, and we're so divided in, at least if I talk from journalism and our profession, of saying there's some who are very much on one side and some who are very much on the other. And as somebody kind of in the middle is hard to find these days.
Yeah, I think, but I think it's important also, it depends on the output as well, right? Like, so will the next Van Gogh be like from an LLM? Probably not. Right. So if it's a very like distinctive art piece, because in the end, these models learn from what is there and build from what is there. So that's also why I believe if you look into so for prototyping, building things that have been built like 10,000 times, like a login screen or something like this, you can get something out of it. But like in the end, also, if you look at the current outputs, design-wise, they look very similar because it's clear, right? That's it's a probability. So if you want to do like really big jumps in innovation in design, it still needs another input, at least like to push it in that way. If then the way to build it and to bring it into your product needs to be by hand, craft is a different topic. But I think this doing the selection and deciding also what is worth maybe putting there, which route you go, gets even more important in the future. Yeah, and also for journalism, I would say I don't want to have an article that is only written by ChatGPT that I could have like getting myself, right? Like that's basically the thing. I want that. From my perspective, I want journalism that where people are on the ground and then bring their information back, like first-hand information, because this is what the AI, at least currently, can't do. Yeah, and so I think that's an interesting debate. But for me, it really depends on the output format a little bit. What is the right choice? And maybe in between, it can help you like getting there, right? So anyway.
I completely agree. I think there's we're in fact in a moment where if we do this correctly, it can just actually boost the human touch of everything, because that's where the real value is now. You know, whereas before things that were maybe kind of clickbaity or automated that made money, brought ad revenue, got people and kind of took up people's times. Now it doesn't because we have tools that can do it automatically.
Yeah.
I just hope that there is no automated podcast host coming anytime soon, or else
probably it will as well. But like in the end, it also like helps us maybe valuing real people, real kind of products, and even like what we actually believe, that travel will become an even more important thing, because people might not spend so much time or want to spend at some point so much time in the digital world, because like a lot of AI slop, you don't even know if this cool video that you just looked at is real, right? So it can be that people get a fatigue from it, and then that real like kind of experiences, which is often travel, get even of a higher value then.
Right. Okay. Well, this is it for sure. This is goodbye. I'm very glad we did touch on this, because it is interesting, and I'm glad you want to speak on it too, because I know that this is just talking about you and your opinion, doesn't really have much to do with home to go. But you did connect it there at the end, which I hadn't thought about. But you're right that there is a travel element to it of people wanting to get away from the digital world now that it's becoming more and more automated and valuing that human experience. So thank you for the insights. I'll save these questions for the next time, and we can just pick it up from there.
Great. It was great.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Patrick.